This is New Hampshire Calling, a pop-up show from NHPR, where we help each other navigate daily life in this time of uncertainty. I'm Jack Rodolico, live in Concord. So, ordinarily, the way I'd start off is to ask you a question, something that piques your curiosity, that gets you to pick up your phone and call me to talk. I'd give you the number, I'd give you the email address, and say, come on, call me, talk to me. But not tonight. New Hampshire Calling has been on the air since March. We put this show together with some creativity and a whole lot of duct tape in a matter of days. We slapped it on the air, opened the phone lines, and ever since, we've been asking you all about how you are coping with this pandemic. We've made some hard pivots during that time, too. We started talking about how you cope with racism in New Hampshire, and it's truly been an amazing series of conversations about this moment we are all navigating together. And so tonight, I'm actually not going to ask you to call in and participate. We're going to do it a little bit differently. I'm going to ask you to listen. I've lined up a few guests who I'm really excited to talk to and who I think have something to say about where we might be going as a state. I'll speak with Abenaki leaders about what can only be described as a sort of monumental problem, a large stone and racist monument that depicts Indigenous people as nothing more than a handful of scalps. And we'll talk about how the Black Lives Matter movement is giving them, as Indigenous Granite Staters, maybe an opening to turn the page on this long-ignored chunk of very offensive rock. Then I'm going to speak with someone who has a ground-level understanding about how the pandemic and the joblessness crisis is rippling across the state. She's also a single mom and a blackjack dealer. Stick around for that one. That'll be in a little bit. And then before we say goodbye, a bit of music, which has been a staple of this show. So no calls during the show tonight, but we still want to hear from you. While this pop-up show is popping down for a while, we want to take time here at NHPR to reflect and make sure when and if we do pop up again, that we are better for it. So if you would, maybe take a few minutes to give us some feedback about New Hampshire Calling online. It would be great if you would fill out our survey. I know, who wants to stop to fill out a survey? If you did it, it would mean so much to us. It would help us learn who you are, what we've done well, what we could do better. Go to nhpr.org, click on the New Hampshire Calling page. That's under the programs tab. And it'll be the first post you see. Or just Google New Hampshire Calling NHPR survey. I bet you can find it that way, too. So now on to our show. You know, maybe you've seen the imagery of crowds tearing down monuments to Confederate generals down south, and maybe that feels very far away. If it does, I'd encourage you to take a drive to Boscawen, right in the middle of New Hampshire. Get off on exit 17 of I-93, park in the park and ride that's right there, and walk a short distance down a trail. Don't worry, it's all well marked. You're going to see where you're going. Down there, you will find a statue that rivals any monument to the Confederacy you could find in the American South. What is that monument? What does it stand for? And what could be next for it? That's what I'll speak with my first guests now. They join me via Zoom, Paul and Denise Puglio. Welcome to New Hampshire Calling. It's good to have you.
Hi. Welcome, Jack.
Yeah.
Hi.
Awesome.
Why, hello.
Hello, hello. Okay, so here's what I want people to know briefly about both of you. Paul, you are the Sagamo or head male speaker, and Denise, you are the Sagamo Squaw or head female speaker of the Kawasak Band of the Penacook Abenaki people. And you have known about this monument for a long time, you're nodding your heads and sort of rolling your eyes, right? This thing is, I'm going to try to describe this thing or describe who she was and then give you the floor, because this thing is sort of complicated. Hannah Dustin was this frontierswoman, okay, in the late 1600s, who during wars between American colonial, what would be American colonialists, British colonialists, French colonialists, and Native Americans, was abducted from Haverhill, Massachusetts, by what was probably a group of Abenaki. She was brought up the Merrimack River from Haverhill, and she killed a group of Native Americans in the middle of the night, including a bunch of children, and escaped, got back to Haverhill. She became a colonial hero whose story became a sort of propaganda, right? And when you go out to this island, it is the size of a monument you would see in the middle of a city park, right? I mean, can you guys describe what this thing looks like and maybe what feelings it evokes for you?
It's a 30-foot tall stone figure of a woman holding a hatchet in her right hand and 10 scalps in her left hand. The monument is to honor Hannah Dustin as being a heroine for escaping the Abnaki and returning home during the time of war.
Well, it's more important that she actually, as a pioneer woman, if you want to call her that, she was able to kill 10 of us in our sleep. And that was the real crux of the thing. Getting back was a no great feat, but killing 10 of us was like unheard of. A woman killed men, women, and children in their sleep and then escaped and returned back home.
Right. Yeah.
So Cotton Mather took this opportunity to use Hannah as a form of propaganda to help.
Well, in the day, Puritans always believed that God didn't shine well on them if they did something wrong. It was because they weren't religious enough. So this was a sign, you know, the captivity and everything. And her redemption was a sign that she did the right thing by killing us savages. So
right,
in the construct of the Puritanism, she looked pretty powerful because she was able to do this.
And Cotton Mather, you know, and let's be clear that, like, Hannah Dustin tells her story to Cotton Mather, who was this, people might remember vaguely from history lessons, right, that he was this fire and brimstone preacher with a lot of influence during colonial times. And he spread her story, and he was a subjective narrator. He was not objective, and he's basically the only firsthand account. Okay, now let's put Hannah Dustin herself to rest, because that was a long time ago, and the monument was built like more than 100 years later, and it was built in the late 1800s. And again, this is a monument that's still standing. It's on an island in the middle of the Merrimack River in Boscawen, but this is an island very close to shore with a little footbridge, and people are out there all the time with families and kids. This 30-foot stone monument, it's now covered in red spray paint or buckets of paint. I can't tell which. And, you know, this thing was built in the context of the 1800s when there were genocides going on of Native Americans out west. What was the status of the Abenaki here when the Dustin Monument was going up, you know, in a grand ceremony with the governor there in the late 1800s?
We were severely oppressed. Our lands were still being taken.
By the 1800s,
we're struggling.
By the 1800s, we were forced into assimilation, acculturation, and some were able to flee, you know, to Canada to take refuge. But it was the whole from the 1700s on up until 1800, she was pretty much unheard of. I mean, she seemed to disappear from history. It wasn't until the revival of the Indian Wars in the Plains, the desire to expand west. You had Jackson, you had all the Indian Plains Wars. This became kind of a propaganda issue that this was God's will to you know, dominate indigenous people.
Manifest destiny. I mean, this is the term like that we learned. Many of us learned in school that it was the nation's destiny to inherit this land and take it.
I like the dialogue that, you know, American virtue was always liberty was always a woman with the scales and the Statue of Liberty. So the woman's virtue was pure and innocent of everything, but we're a warring nation at the time. So they transposed this relationship of her women's virtue into her, and that was a justification for us as a country to dominate and assimilate indigenous people all the way across the country. Okay. So it was a good thing for propaganda as the march of progress went west.
And so then, you know, for a long time, this monument has been on this island in Boscawen since the late 1800s. Okay. And it was a big to-do when it was put up. And then it has not been much of a to-do since then. And I know that you have both known about it for a long time. I know that Indigenous people have found it offensive for a long time. And then George Floyd's death happens in Minneapolis, and there are protests around the country, and Black Lives Matter and youth are leading protests here in New Hampshire. Talk about how Hannah Duston's monument is, how have you both been kind of sucked into a conversation about, hey, what do we do with this monument that we've got in our own backyard here in New Hampshire?
Well, here in New Hampshire, we have two monuments, Franklin Pierce in front of the State House and Hannah Duston. And those seem to be the two major monuments that are in question right now in New Hampshire. So we want to do better than what the rest of the nation has been doing and open up dialogue and expand education in the state. So Hannah's story may have been filled with propaganda and some manipulation, but it still played a crucial role in American history, and there still needs to be a place for that. So what we decided to do is a small group of us, Megan Howie, an anthropologist and archaeologist at UNH, Christine DeLucia, who is a history professor at Williams University in Massachusetts, Paul and myself, along with Andrew Cushing from Parks and Recreation and Ben Wilson from New Hampshire Historic Resources.
You got tribal leaders, you've got academics and state officials around a table talking about this monument. Go ahead.
Well, around the video camera.
Around Zoom, yeah. because we are in a pandemic. Yeah, keep going. Yeah.
We're being socially, distant.
Yeah.
But we got on Zoom and we had a real conversation about where we are as a nation and where we could be. So after some conversation, we pitched an idea of turning the Hannah Duston site into a greater site of learning. So there's the railroad tracks that grew through that site. There's a lot of history to be told about the railroads. Who laid those tracks? Who carved through the mountains in order to get the trains up this way? And where were they even going? With the river, sure, we canoed and, we did a lot of commerce on the river, but there was a lot of logging going on in this region. There were men riding logs that people don't really know the story about that. There's, the Wild River and, the crazy stories that happen with that and within its own.
And you're talking about, so this is, again, this is an island that's pretty accessible. It's actually the first, it's sort of the opening gates for a long bike trail. The rails are being used with those tourist railroad bike things that I don't quite understand, but people go out and seem to like them. There are people out there. It's a swimming spot. Like, I've always kind of thought of this as a forgotten little corner of the state, but I was out there recently on a warm day, and it seems like a place where you could be teaching people something, and it sounds like you are trying in the beginning stages of a conversation to contextualize that monument, not necessarily tear it down, but provide a broader understanding of history, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. There's more of a story that should be told, and we should be a more inclusive state within our history. If we want to have a common future together, we need to have a common past. And we feel that this is a great opportunity to start that common past.
Yeah. Go ahead, Paul.
No, when we look at historical markers in the state, a lot of them were vintage markers that talked about massacres that we inflicted on small villages and people. But it never was put in its context of what was the backstory. Why did it happen? And so we were working at UNH trying to look at all of the locations, and this Hannah Duston Monument was one of them. And what we've been trying to work out, there are backstories and narratives that could be to explain some of the circumstances a little more fully, not just she was just brutally taken to New Hampshire and she escaped. She killed 10 people and got scalps and bounty and all that stuff. I think there's more of a story that has to be told of why. It was King William's War. There were wars going across the entire world between France and in England and Spain, and these wars all ended up in New England one time.
Right, and so Hannah Duston is this monument on the island of Boscawen is representative of a kind of monument that you can see scattered around the state, where it's a highway placard or a chunk of stone that says like here is the spot where a frontiers town was massacred by a group of Abenaki or a group of Native Americans, and that's the sort of side of history that is being told there. I mean, the thing is, too, like, it seems like this moment for Black Lives Matter and protest, there are other kinds of anti-Native American imagery in this state, like school mascots, the infamous school mascot. And schools have been reaching out to you for guidance after years of kind of silence or inaction on what to do next, right?
Yes. Last fall, we worked with Merrimack Valley High School in Concord, and we permanently retired their indigenous mascot there. We're currently working with Winnakunnet to retire their indigenous mascot. There's currently 9 schools that are on our list that we're currently working with between New Hampshire and Massachusetts to retire their mascots. And we're extremely grateful that that time has finally arrived.
I think the Black Lives Matter issue brought it forefront very quickly that race in this country needs a better narrative. We started to see monuments of Christopher Columbus being torn down, as well as the Confederate monuments. We started to say this is a lost opportunity to really put another image about what the history of New Hampshire was like. And we really think it's a great opportunity to kind of include all these other facets of history, especially that particular island and its location.
Yeah. Well, again, this is the beginning stages of a conversation you're having with the state. But people can, check it out for themselves. Go to exit 17 off I-93, take a good long look at the Hannah Duston Monument. It's thought-provoking, if nothing else, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's a great mystery to find out what really happened on that island.
Yeah.
If it happened on the island.
That's the big thing. We're
yeah.
not sure.
Yeah. But like we said, we won't get we'll talk about it today, right, instead of back then. Denise and Paul Puglio, I really want to thank you for coming on New Hampshire Calling on our last show here and giving us a sense of what might be next for this monument and a bigger conversation in the state. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much.
It's you, Lenny. Great thanks.
Thank you very much. This is New Hampshire Calling. I'm Jack Rodolico. Stay with us. This is our final airing in this marathon run for our pop-up show. More conversation when we return. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is New Hampshire Calling, a pop-up show from NHPR, where we help each other navigate daily life in this time of uncertainty. I'm Jack Rodolico, live in Concord. Tonight is our last show in this run we've had since March. We are not taking your calls as we do every other show because it's our last show. We wanted to do something a little different rather than talk about this moment and how you're coping with it. I wanted to track down a couple of people who might have a sense of where we are going, and maybe all of us can just sit back and listen to them for a little while. In preparing these shows over the last few months, I've talked to a lot of people, all of us who produce this show, who we didn't get on the air, who just didn't fit, or we didn't have enough time for them. So many incredible people. And there was one woman whose voice I really wanted to find a way to feature. I think because she does a job that is not glamorous, but is important. She does that job in a part of the state that doesn't get a lot of attention, and she's been doing it there for a long time, while also being a mom and a volunteer and a lot of other things. And she's got a finger on the pulse of poverty in New Hampshire. She understood poverty in New Hampshire before the pandemic, and she worries about where it's going next. Today is the first day that Governor Chris Sununu's executive order protecting tenants from eviction will be lifted since the pandemic slammed into the economy a few months ago. As someone with New Hampshire Legal Assistance recently told NHPR, quote, "We anticipate that we are going to see a tsunami of eviction cases." If and when that tsunami comes and those folks are evicted, if they're evicted in Berlin up north, they may end up in the office of Angela Martin-Giroux, that city's health and welfare director. I spoke with her about the work she does and how she keeps her head above water. I just want to say I'm really grateful to you for taking time to talk to me multiple times over the last month. By way of establishing who you are and your bona fides, right? Let's just start by introducing yourself. Who are you and what do you do?
I'm Angela Martin-Giroux. I'm Director of Health and Welfare for the City of Berlin. I have a master's degree in counseling psychology, and I'm a mother of a special needs child here in Berlin, Gorham. Been a foster parent and a volunteer in the community, you name it.
A little bit of everything.
Yeah.
Okay. And so as the health and welfare director of the City of Berlin, a lot of smaller cities have this position. It's not a position that's in the news much, but you work a lot. You're always there. How would you describe what it is that you do in the City of Berlin and have been doing there in this position for 20 years, right?
It started out just as welfare. Went from just doing welfare to being the health officer who handles everything from health and safety in the community to inspecting or self-inspecting. So I inspect restaurants.
Hold on. I want to understand this. You are doing welfare, so you're dealing with individuals who are in need and need some, whether it's financial assistance, something like that. You also inspect restaurants?
Yes. I will go out and take care of health complaints about general things in the community. So if someone has an issue with their apartment, I'll go out and inspect those things.
Can you give me an example?
So we had recently an apartment building with multiple apartments, and there was an overwhelming smell of urea and fecal matter. Things with some animals that weren't being cared for the way that they needed to be, and it was affecting the public health of the other tenants, and we helped find a way for the tenants in that apartment to work with their landlord to come to a solution that was best for them and for the rest of the people in that building.
Angel, it sounds like you're describing multiple jobs, like that you do. You sound like you're describing several distinct jobs done by a city, but that you do all of them.
Yes.
Okay, so I have that right.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a fecal smell in an apartment building. You go to that. If there's a restaurant inspection needed, you go to that. But also, like if a single mom of three kids needs some sort of financial support, what is that? She comes in and how can you help her?
If someone's basic needs are less than their income and assets, we can assist with the difference. If their basic needs can be covered by their income and assets, we can't assist. I'll sit down with the person and say, okay, let's look at what's going on and see if there's some way we can help you figure out how to make what you have work. And then once you get the program, how can you budget so that you can maintain or get ahead?
Really?
Like
you'll do like a kitchen table budget with a family to help them get on top of their expenses?
Yeah. Yep. In depth. Everything. We'll look at, how do you put money aside for your registration that comes 6 months from now, and haircuts and Christmas and birthdays, and because life happens, things happen. They pay off one bill and another one comes up.
Mm-hmm. Now, okay, so you have been initially the welfare director, but also the health director for the City of Berlin for a long time now, for, 20 years. So you have a sort of a bird's eye view of a lot of different things, but I kind of want to say poverty and working poor in that part of the state. Give me the bird's eye view of what things were like before the pandemic hit in March and the economy shut down. Like, before we even bring that in, what was the scene?
What we saw here in this office was a lot of the working poor. So you had people that have jobs, working for restaurants or stores or motels and hotels and some small industries. So they're making that $8 to $14 an hour, typical type of stuff. And there are moms and dads who may not have paid time off. So, you know, if you have an incident where your car breaks down, there's not a lot of extra money to fix that. Or if your child is sick and you have to stay home with them, you don't have paid time. Or if you're sick, you may not have paid time for that. So things can get dicey if there's one expense or one thing that goes wrong.
I mean, it sounds like there are a lot of scenarios, but perhaps a commonality is people who are paycheck to paycheck, and one thing can happen, one bill, one expected thing, and they're in the welfare office because they need help.
You know, they're working 20 hours a week to 40 hours a week, and there's just no way for them to change their situation. They're doing what they're supposed to do.
Okay, so that's the scene prior to the pandemic hits, the economy shuts down. What has changed since then, and where do you see us going down the line?
When COVID hit and people had to stay home because their children were suddenly home or they had health concerns that made them immunocompromised and potentially more exposed to the viral load, we suddenly were getting calls from people who were concerned because it took a very long time for them to get unemployment. So they were living off of what they had from tax returns and then from...
Because it was tax season when this thing started, so people got a rebate, little boost.
And then, you know, they were anticipating the stimulus check. And some people didn't, you know, plan with that. Some people had some savings. So we weren't seeing an uptick in the working poor coming in at that point in time. What we were seeing is people calling in anticipation of what they would do when their saved funds ran out. So I spent a lot of time fielding questions on where do I go and who do I talk to? And is this going to be okay?
Mm-hmm. It sort of occurs to me as you're describing, you know, you are part of a local safety net for people. And so you are aware of the state and federal programs that are generally available.
Yes.
Pandemic hits, new safety nets are put in place by the federal government and the state. That's, you know, can't be evicted. That's from the state. You know, you get a check in the mail, that's from the federal government. It sounds like you are seeing in real time people working poor relying on those little bits of assistance from the state and federal government. Clarify for me where we are right now as of July 1st and all these individuals in the North Country and probably elsewhere who are on the verge of losing some of these protections. Like, how is that going to play out in real life?
So as of July 1st, these protections on rent and electricity and various other utilities is being lifted under the executive order. So anything that they owe to landlords and mortgage companies and electric and other utilities is going to be collectible. So they can
all of it at the same time is going to be collectible.
So, yes. So they can start to get disconnect notices. They can start to get notices to quit, demand for rent, and be taken to court on those. Now, for rent, they're given 7 days under the state law to come up with the entire amount that they owe. And then they can be taken to court on that under eviction, which isn't a huge time frame when you owe perhaps March, April, May, and June.
And these are people who are elderly, people with kids, like young people. Yeah. Like, is this everybody, every age?
Yes.
Really? And every family makeup?
You know, people with disabilities even, who don't know where to start.
I mean, are we heading towards a housing crisis and a homelessness crisis?
Potentially, if people are not able to do what it takes to negotiate with their landlord to come and keep a payment plan, or to go to the agencies and follow through, or otherwise come up with the monies that they owe, we could be facing multiple evictions all at once and overwhelming the courts. You know, I've talked to landlords, and there are a lot of people who have not paid anything, unfortunately, during this time period. Nothing. I don't know the reasons behind it. I don't know if it's because they didn't have it, or if they had money coming in from unemployment, the stimulus check or whatever, and chose to do other things. It's not up to me to judge that, but I don't know if they thought it through what it was going to mean at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So
this sounds like really emotionally draining work that you do. Is it? And do you have like barriers to keep yourself okay?
The key is to be empathetic, but to learn, with like anybody in social work, learn how to, as much as possible, leave it at the door at the end of the day. If you don't, you get burned out really quickly. And, you know, if you possibly can, to have a counselor of your own, mm-hmm. to have great coping skills, to have hobbies and your own support system that you can turn to, and to understand that if people come in and they take things out on you, it's not you personally, it's the life experience that they're upset with.
So you said leave it at the door when you go home. When you leave the door and go home, what's life like for you?
I'm a single mom. I'm a homeowner. I have a second job that I work part-time after I leave here. And I have a child with multiple disabilities that I work with and try to help him learn life skills so that he can function the best he can when he becomes an adult. So
it's just easy when you leave. What you're telling me is life is just easy when you walk out of the office every day.
Yes, I go home and I sun my face every day.
You just read a book and have a drink, right? So, what's your son's name?
Devin.
Tell me something about Devin.
Devin is, in some ways, your typical 13-year-old. He loves to play video games and
Understood, yeah.
And he's the light of my life, and you know, he really is the reason that I get up every day, go to work, and stay focused on what my goals are, because I want to make sure that he understands that you have to have a reason to focus in life and have goals, and there are reasons to have responsibilities, and it doesn't matter if you have a disability or multiple disabilities. You have to have expectations for yourself and try your hardest to reach those and pick yourself up every day and continue. Even if you don't meet those expectations, there's always another day. So.
How does he understand this pandemic and what has been a change to all of our lives? I'm sure a big change to his, like, how does he understand it and process it? I don't know if there's something we need to understand more about him to answer that question. So however you want to answer it.
His dad's a teacher, and with my background, we both have sat down with him and we've talked about it together and separately about what it all means. And we, practice like wearing masks and why we are doing this. And I actually had to go get testing for COVID. So I brought him with me and he watched it being done, and we explained the process and why it was being done. Because we believe in, you know, education and having him understand as much as he can from whatever we're doing. So he's actually doing pretty good. The hardest thing for him is the social isolation. He misses having the ability to go and communicate with his friends and have that social interaction at school. And he's expressing that he really wants to go back to school for that.
And he says that clearly.
Yes. Yeah. When can I go back to school? So we're kind of waiting to see what schools are going to do to see how this will affect kids. This has been hard on kids.
You paint a picture of the work you do being very big picture. You've got this bird's eye view of the city and poverty and the working poor there, but that you also make the time to do very small things like make a budget with someone who's struggling. What's the connection there?
When you look at health is, you have to look at health as a whole view. There's financial health, mental health, physical health. It all plays in together. So as the welfare officer and the health officer, public health means food stability, housing stability. All of that plays a role into how you have a healthy community. If you cannot look at your community as a whole and picture where those things are lacking and how you can help each individual find their place in that and make themselves and their families more secure in those things, the community itself is not going to be healthier. And that's public health.
Angela, I really appreciate talking with you and I appreciate you making some time.
You should check in with our casino sometime.
I should check in with your casino?
Yeah.
Why? Are they going to take my money or am I going to win something?
I don't know, but did you know we have a charitable casino here?
No, I didn't know you have a charitable casino in Berlin.
Yeah.
All the money goes to charity?
A good portion of it goes to charity. Yeah. It's at a former church even.
No kidding. The things I don't know about Berlin, New Hampshire. That is pretty cool. Oh, man. Well, thanks for telling me.
In my spare time, I'm a blackjack dealer.
For some reason, that doesn't surprise me after getting to know you a little bit.
Have a good day.
Yeah, you too. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. That was Angela Martin-Drew, Health and Welfare Director for the City of Berlin, New Hampshire. And a quick correction, she said in there that the eviction period is 7 days for tenants. It's actually been extended to 30 days. When we come back in our final segment, we're going to hear a highlight reel of some of our favorite moments on this show and then end it off with a bit of music. This is New Hampshire Calling. I'm Jack Rodolico. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is New Hampshire Calling, a pop-up show from NHPR. I'm Jack Rodolico, live in Concord. Okay, we are in the home stretch here on our final segment in this run of shows from New Hampshire Calling. Probably my favorite thing about New Hampshire Calling has been the complete randomness, seemingly, of the calls that come in. It seems to always be a touch of the sacred, followed by a touch of the profane, then maybe more sacred or maybe more profane, depending on the night. And in honor of all those callers who really make this show what it is, and I mean that sincerely, we're going to play you a highlight reel of some of the funniest, sweetest, and most sincere moments we've had. Most of what you're about to hear is actually just from the first month or so we were on the air. Here it is. Enjoy. Welcome back. I'm Jack Rodolico, and this is New Hampshire Calling, a live pop-up show from NHPR that's all about how we can help each other navigate daily life in this time of a pandemic. Right now, we are talking about stimulus checks. We are talking tonight about introverts and extroverts. We're talking about grief. We're talking about joy tonight. We're going to go now to Littleton. Kevin is calling from up in North Conway. Hey. Jane is calling from Manchester. Heather is on the line from Swansea. Hey. I know a lot of people are on the phones. Stay with us. We're going to try to get to all of you. You live in an apartment building in Nashua.
Right.
You're 90 years old.
Right.
And you love bingo, and you can't play it right now.
Oh, yeah.
I'm at the prison. I've been here since mid-80s.
Oh, I'm rocking it because I'm psychotic.
And the thing is, I also crave attention.
Well, I live in a converted van, so I don't even have a roommate. The only roommate I have is a dog.
I have joint custody of a little dachshund, 10-pound dachshund named Frank.
Put the phone closer to him so we can hear him better.
So I made a workbench and boxes for my tools.
I get up early every day
and I go straight into my morning workout. I'm 30 years old, and I'm single. And, you know, when this coronavirus is over, I want to be ready.
You know, I'm like hemorrhaging cash, taxes, insurance.
Paying off the light bill,
electric, gas.
The biggest thing I've noticed has been more being, like, less able to cope with just, like, the small stressors of life.
At the beginning of the year, my dad went into the hospital at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, and he died.
And then 3 weeks after my grandfather died, his wife, my grandmother, died.
You know, you miss the hugs and you miss, you know, the closeness.
All these losses of things that you didn't realize that you were taking for granted.
Very different. It's very different, and it makes me feel very old.
That mixture of happy and sadness, of joy and sorrow, is really important in getting through a crisis.
In my lap right now, sleeping on me, I have an eight-day-old baby.
Oh, man.
I have a 4-day-old.
4-day-old.
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
Being in a crisis or being alone gives you a chance to think about, you know, important things.
And it's really inspiring to see them, you know, working for humanity, going beyond religious borders and helping everybody in need.
Oh, thanks so much for taking my call. I love this show.
You put a smile on my face today. You really have with this show. It makes me feel very comfortable in my own skin.
I started listening to the other stories, and I was identifying, and I was appreciating my own hardship that I'm going through. You know, you kind of think, oh, it's just me.
I just popped some corn, and I'm sitting there eating popcorn and listening to you guys.
Okay, that's it. We're going to play you a great song on the way out after the credits in just a moment here, so stick around. I want to thank you so much for listening tonight, and I want to thank the SWAT team of producers and editors and staff who've kept this show together over the months. Tonight, Mark Erickson ran the board and Christina Phillips produced. Thank you to you both. New Hampshire Calling has been produced by Emily Quirk. Pete Nakos is our community engagement producer. Corey Princell is NHPR's managing editor. Maureen McMurray is our show's executive producer. Don't forget, check out that survey online. Google NH Calling NHPR survey. You'll find it. We'd love to get your feedback. This is New Hampshire Calling. I'm Jack Rodolico. And remember, we are all in this together. And now turn it up a bit because we're going to end with Nina Simone. And not just any song, Nina Simone covering George Harrison. It's Isn't It a Pity, here on New Hampshire Calling.
About yet, but I'm gonna tell you soon. It's a pity. Isn't it a pity? Isn't it a shame? Yes, how we break each other's hearts and cause each other pain. How we take each other's love without thinking anymore. Forgetting to give back, forgetting to remember, just forgetting a note of thank you. Isn't it a pity? Some things take so long, but how do I explain when not too many people can see we all just the same? we're all guilty because of all their tears. Our eyes just can't hope to see, though I don't think it's applicable to me, the beauty that surrounds them. Child, isn't it a pity? How we break each other's hearts. Cause each other pain. How we take each other's love, the most precious thing, without thinking anymore. Getting to keep open our door. Isn't it a pity? Isn't it a pity? Some things take so long, but how do I explain? Isn't it a pity when not too many people surrounds them? Maybe that's why we cry. God, it's a pity. Lord knows it's a pity. Mankind has been so programmed, they don't care about nothing that has to do with care. C-A-R-E. How we take each other's love, the most precious thing, without thinking anymore. See, we're just the same. And because of all their tears.